You. This is Kathy Diaz, the Monday host of The Global Village, encouraging you to contribute now. Go to kpfk.org, then click Sustainer Circle. Whatever you can do, please do. Thank you.
This is Michelle Schacht, and you're listening to radio, powered by the people, KPFK. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer, and this week, I'll examine how and why the Trump administration is randomly bombing ships in the Caribbean, killing dozens under the dishonest claims of combating drug trafficking. My guest will be Guillaume Wong, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Then we'll turn to Tom Moore at the Center for American Progress, whose white paper on how to void the Citizens United ruling at the state level will see its first real-world test. Moore will explain how Montana voters in 2026 will likely see a ballot measure redefining what a corporation is in order to salvage democracy. Finally, Jean Sue, Energy Director of Center for Biological Diversity, will discuss a new report about how AI data centers are spewing carbon emissions at an alarming rate and what communities can do about it. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. For months now, the Trump administration has been building up military hardware in and around the Caribbean and making inflammatory statements implying an impending war with Venezuela. U.S. airstrikes on ships in the region have killed dozens of people under the dubious claim of illegal narcotics shipments being targeted. But in a recent CBS interview, Trump claimed it was unlikely he would launch a war on Venezuela. My guest is Guillaume Wong. He is a senior research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's held several cabinet positions in the government of Ecuador, including Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Culture, and Minister of Knowledge and Human Talent. Most recently, he served as Ecuador's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva. Welcome to the program, Guillaume.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure.
So I feel as though looking at what Trump is doing in Venezuela, well, we really need to go back to the very beginning of his term this January, where he signed an executive order declaring drug traffickers to be effectively foreign terrorists, designating cartels and other organizations as foreign terrorist organizations and specially designated global terrorists. That was the name of his executive order. Is this what he is drawing from, as far as you can tell, in terms of creating his own authority to drop bombs and to make threats against Venezuela?
Yeah, I think this, we have to differentiate a few things. I think you're absolutely right. Naming cartels, terrorist organizations, and sort of doubling down on the war on drugs and really sort of heightening and raising the tone of the whole war on drugs and making that parallel between war on drugs and war on terror, which is not the first time it's been done. The word narco-terrorism goes back now a couple of decades. It was done under the Bush administration as well. But doing all this has been one of the aspects of the Trump administration in the Western Hemisphere, and it's in the U.S. policy towards Latin America. And it's part and parcel of a return to Latin America under a security guise, right? And we're really seeing the United States securitizing, I don't really like that verb, but, you know, making security the big deal of US's approach towards Latin America. It is all about security, which essentially means US policy towards Latin America right now is all about big stick, right? It's about security. It's about, now we're going to be talking about it, it's about gunboat diplomacy. It's about wielding a big stick. And there's not much carrot. It's all about, you know, do this or else. And the war on drugs plays a big role in this. It also means the United States makes itself present and makes its military present in Latin America. The war on drugs has become a real leitmotif for that presence. So, for example, in military bases, fight the cartels, to fight narco traffickers, not to fight, you know, what used to be, you know, communist threat or other threats. It's the real threat that's basically justifying the U.S. presence in its hemisphere and the U.S.'s military presence and security presence in the Western Hemisphere. So we're seeing a lot of stick, not much carrot, as in not much economic incentives, you know, not much on offer, but a lot of security relations between the United States and Latin America, and it's all based on the war on drugs. Now, I will argue to you that I think that the latest military buildup in the Caribbean off the coast of Venezuela has actually very little to do with drugs and with fighting the cartels, and much more to do with regime change, the reassertion of U.S. power in the Western Hemisphere, the Monroe Doctrine, and all these other things, because I think Venezuela plays a relatively minor role in the drug trade. But in more general terms, for sure, the war on drugs is a major pillar of the Trump administration's policy towards Latin America, and the securitization of that policy, which is basically what the Trump administration has in its arsenal, in its relations with Latin American states, potentially with the exception of Argentina, where there's an economic component. With all the other states, it's really all about security.
Right. I mean, and these claims around drug trafficking, the government is claiming that it is to do with fentanyl production, which, as far as even the New York Times did, you know, an article kind of examining this claim, is completely false. It's not a route that fentanyl takes. And so even with cocaine, it's not a common route. The Pacific route is far more common. So this is, you know, it's not even really trying to hide, if you will, or hide very well its intent, it seems, right?
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, just to be extremely clear, there's total consensus across the board amongst all experts on narcotics, counter-narcotics, narco-trafficking, criminal organizations, so on and so forth, that fentanyl does not transit via Venezuela. And of course, the big drugs crisis in the United States is the opioid crisis. Fentanyl is the big killer, much more than cocaine. So, leaving aside that issue, which obviously, you know, is a big issue because fentanyl is the big killer, and just focusing on cocaine, still we see that cocaine transits through Venezuela, but Venezuela is a marginal point of transit. As you said, much of the cocaine, which is still today being produced largely in Colombia, actually exits Colombia via the southern border into Ecuador, and into Peru. Those are the two countries on the South American Pacific coast that are currently most responsible for transiting cocaine from Colombia en route to the United States and to Europe, actually, to both destinations. Whereas Venezuela, again, plays, there is some cocaine undoubtedly going through Venezuela, but it's marginal. So if you were really going after drugs, then, you know, Venezuela's sort of a fair bit down on the list of culprits on countries you would target. So the whole rationale of the military buildup in the Southern Caribbean is dubious for sure. And I think most analysts, again, concur that it's mostly about trying to achieve regime change after a number of failures. We can cover those over the last few years in Venezuela, and a more general military presence in the Western Hemisphere that sort of serves as a reassertion again of gunboat diplomacy, right? Which was the diplomacy of the first few decades of the 20th century, and the policy of the big stick.
And you point out in a piece you wrote for Center for Economic and Policy Research that the DEA's own National Drug Assessment Threat Assessment from 2024 doesn't even mention Venezuela. Now, in identifying Tren de Aragua, which is this supposedly dangerous drug cartel, is the Trump administration also trying to cover its bases, or sort of create a through line between domestic and foreign policy? Because it's that same cartel that it has cited repeatedly in its justifications for rounding up undocumented immigrants in the United States through ICE raids in cities around the country, creating these scenarios that don't exist, that, you know, essentially attacking innocent people with the claims that they're rounding up gang members from Tren de Aragua. Does this justification help him, you know, kill two birds with one stone domestically and in the foreign realm?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the rationale behind it. There's certainly a big domestic rationale, because we know crime is a key preoccupation in all U.S. polls, the economy and crime kind of top.
Regardless of the actual reality.
Yeah, we're talking about perceptions here rather than the actual reality. But it's true, particularly in the Trump base, in the MAGA base, there's a lot of concern with perceived criminality and crime. So we know that plays into his base, and there's a domestic angle to this. But it's actually worse than that, because the Trump administration, in fact, even invented a cartel that doesn't exist, right? The Cartel de los Soles, the Cartel of Suns, which again, really doesn't exist. The turn comes from the early 90s, because there were two Venezuelan officers that were involved with drug trafficking. And so some, I can't remember which media, talked of the Cartel of the Suns, but it's never really been a thing. It's these two officers. And so it's been kind of fished out from way before Maduro times, or even way before Chavez times. This is from the early 90s, right? And they've reinvented this, rebranded it, and created a thing. And again, there's broad consensus in the security community and the experts on this that this doesn't exist. Now, the Tren de Aragua does exist. But again, the Tren de Aragua is more of a gang than a cartel. And, you know, it doesn't operate in ways that have been suggested by the U.S. administration. It's involved in mostly involved in human trafficking more than drug trafficking in the last few years. And largely, this is the whole irony of the story, but largely as a result of the economic decline in Venezuela and a lot of Venezuelans leaving Venezuela, in no small part as a result of U.S. sanctions, right? There's a direct correlation between U.S. sanctions and this huge exodus of Venezuelans leaving Venezuela between roughly 2017 and 2020. This is the height of the migration, where you have between 7 and 8 million people, the largest wave of migrants in the contemporary history of Latin America, leaving Venezuela as a result of the crumbling of the Venezuelan economy. Because of the sanctions, Venezuela goes from exporting 1.6 million barrels of oil a day to just over 300,000 barrels of oil a day. The economy crumbles, lots of people leave, and of course, crime thrives in these kinds of circumstances, with the Tren de Aragua being sort of emerging as a sort of organization that helps with the transiting of transit routes and smuggling routes for migrants mainly. Now, it is an organization that exists, but it is dwarfed by drug cartels in Mexico, in Colombia, in Ecuador. It really isn't the thing that the United States is suggesting that it is. So again, we're in this kind of fake rhetoric where Venezuela no doubt has criminal organization, no doubt is transiting, there's some transiting of cocaine taking place, but it's absolutely marginal compared to other actors. And in fact, I would argue that a lot of the cocaine that's going to the US and to Europe, because actually there's a lot of cocaine going to Europe more than to the US, because in the US it's more of an opioid crisis, in Europe it's more of a cocaine crisis. But a lot of the cocaine leaving South America is actually not leaving in these small or medium-sized fishing boats or speedboats or whatever crossing the Caribbean. A lot of it is going in containers, in totally legit containers from sort of key exports of certain countries, including banana exports from Ecuador. That's a big conduit. And these are, you know, on like big cargo ships that go through the Panama Canal, and there seems to be no real policy there, and that's the bulk of the stuff. Let alone, I'm not even going to go into the details of tackling with the issue of consumption, of course, which is unresolved, and the other issue, which is a major issue, which there's a lot of specialists also concur that it should be tackled, is the issue of money laundering, and obviously a lot of it taking place actually inside the United States, particularly in key places like Florida. So, you know, I mean, Venezuela, if this was really about drugs, Venezuela is at the bottom of a list of a number of targets that
right.
you may not be focusing on.
So, Guillaume, let's talk about who the U.S. has been bombing in the Caribbean. I mean, 65 people killed, even if it was true that there were drugs being carried in these boats. Just randomly bombing them and killing people without charging them, without putting them through trial, assuming they're guilty before they've had a chance to defend themselves, that's criminal behavior. It's international crimes, is it not?
That's right. First of all, we don't know who these people are. And just from a law enforcement perspective, it makes absolutely no sense, right? Because if these are, you know, hired, I mean, some of them appear to be fishermen. We have no idea whether they're involved in the drug trade. So, but even in the worst case scenario, if they've been hired by gangs to transport cocaine, then you'd want them, clever law enforcement. And actually, a lot of what the DEA's work has been in the past, right, is about that, is about getting information from low-ranking, you know, traffickers to get information about higher ranking traffickers and go for bigger fish, right? And if you're killing these people, then you're not going to get that intelligence and you're not going to really significantly affect cartel operation. This makes no sense at all. That's from the efficiency side of the story. And then from the lawfulness side of the story, yeah, I mean, a lot of people who are more experts than me on this have made a very, I think, very convincing case that this is extrajudicial killings. It's basically killing people, civilians. This is the United States has not declared war on Venezuela. These are Venezuelan civilians, now also Colombian and Ecuadorian civilians involved. And these countries are not at war with the United States, and therefore they're not legitimate military targets. So yeah, I think we're dealing with absolutely egregious, unlawful behavior, which is why, again, for all these reasons, I don't think this is really fundamentally about, you know, I mean, there's the domestic element we've just talked about. I think those images are useful for domestic purposes. And on the international front, I think it's not really about going after the cartels. I actually think the buildup is about intimidating Venezuela. It's about regime change, and it's about trying to convince military actors inside Venezuela that they should rebel, that they should organize a coup. It's about putting pressure for that outcome to happen.
Guillaume, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the piece that you wrote for a Center for Economic and Policy Research about Trump's moves in Venezuela from our website later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.
My guest has been Guillaume Long, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Ask most ordinary Americans what is the biggest source of corruption in elections, and many would say money in politics, or if they were really well informed, dark money, or the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. For a long time, we've accepted the assumption that the only way to undo the 2010 Supreme Court ruling was for Congress to pass legislation doing so, or for the court itself to change its mind. Both extremely unlikely scenarios. Now, voters in Montana are gearing up to ban corporate dark money in their state in 2026 by using a simple and innovative redefinition of what a corporation is. If they succeed, it could open the door for all states to do the same. My guest is Tom Moore. He's a senior fellow for democracy policy at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and he wrote a definitive paper that first came up with this idea of changing the definition of what a corporation is as a way to undo Citizens United at the state level. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So let's first talk about what it was that the ruling itself said. The Supreme Court made this ruling on its own in 2010. It came seemingly at that time out of nowhere, caught a lot of folks off guard, and has completely changed or worsened or exacerbated our political system in terms of the influence of money. What was it that the Supreme Court actually said was now possible starting 2010?
Sure. What it said was that if you spend independently in elections without coordinating with the candidate, without talking to them, without plotting any strategy or anything like that, if you do that, then that money can't be corrupting. So in an unlimited amount of it wouldn't be corrupting either. Candidate contributions are okay. You can only give $3,000 to this campaign or so forth. If you're giving directly to a candidate, but if you do it independently, an independent expenditure cannot be corrupting, and so it can't be regulated. And the court had held in 1976 that really the only reason that we can regulate campaign spending is if it has if it creates corruption or the appearance of corruption. So, if these independent expenditures, an unlimited number of them, can't be corrupting, then they can't be regulated either. That's what the decision said. And it led to a decision the next year in the case called SpeechNow that actually created what we know as super PACs. And what SpeechNow added to that is, well, if an unlimited number of expenditures can't be corrupting, then an unlimitedly large contribution into a super PAC can't be corrupting either. And that is kind of what built the pathway that we see now, with the huge amounts of money going into super PACs and huge amounts coming out. And most damagingly, money coming from dark money corporations going into these super PACs or being spent directly where there's no disclosure at all. That is the very ugly legacy of Citizens United.
Right. Then I appreciate you being able to explain it in such a bite-sized manner. And it seems as though, on the paper, it's kind of a benign thing. But in effect, it has been so corrupting. How would you express the impact it's had since 2010 before we get into how Montana could finally start to chip away at it?
Yeah, it has damaged people's faith in their democracy, and for good reason. It looks like, if you're looking at what goes on the airwaves and on online ads and that kind of thing, it looks like ordinary people don't have a voice in these elections at all, and they really haven't. The amount of money that's been spent independently since Citizens United came along just skyrocketed. I mean, it's from the low tens of millions to the several billions of dollars per election cycle now. And the way that democracies fall to fascism is that it's when people in the society don't believe that their voices matter, don't believe their votes matter, don't believe that their spending in elections matter, and that their democracy just isn't working for them. And Citizens United was a serious accelerant of that.
So now let's talk about what it is that you came up with. Instead of figuring out how to stop the money flowing on the back end, or how to go the legislative route, which, you know, we can't even figure out, Congress can't even figure out how to fund the government every year, or asking, you know, thinking about the Supreme Court to change its mind, which it won't with a 6-3 supermajority that's conservative. You went to the front end of how one defines a corporation, and that's possible because states, individual states, define what corporations are, what their powers are, what their limitations are. Explain that a little bit more. And this is where we get to the heart of how Montana voters could actually be the first in the nation to undo the effects of Citizens United in their state. How does a state define a corporation, and how could that definition be changed?
Yeah. So for the last 100 years, states have pretty much defined corporations the same way, that they have power to do anything legal, or they pretty much have the same powers as a natural person. And that has led a lot of people to say, like, oh, corporations are people, or fighting against that and saying that corporations aren't people. And it's not true that the law says that they are human people, but it has said for 100 years that they have the powers of human people. But it wasn't always that way. Early in U.S. history, states gave out very limited charters. The laws were much more restrictive. People were afraid of the influence that corporations could have, and so they gave these very limited charters and said, okay, you can be a railroad, and you can exist for only 7 years or 20 years or something like that. But you, over here, you can be a bakery, and that is what you do, and you cannot just do anything you want. And there were good reasons to get away from that. It was super corrupt. The state legislators spent like half their workload cranking out these limited charters. So there's good reason to get rid of it. And they went to these general charters where you can say, like, all right, just pay us a fee, we'll give you a charter, and you can do any kind of business with that. And the late 1800s and early 1900s, states were competing with each other to get more corporate registrations. And so they're kind of giving away more and more powers and privileges and benefits and so forth. And finally, New Jersey jumped ahead of everybody else and said, like, fine, we'll just give them everything. They can do everything a regular person can do, and that's it. And all the other states are like, oh, and they matched that. And that's where it's sat for the last 100 years or so. And that's what we think of as corporations, that, you know, they kind of look like people. They can do all these things. Now they can spend in elections. And
it's... Look like people as in on paper, they can look like people. I mean, of course.
Exactly.
They can't be jailed. Yeah.
No, and there's some really important things, like, you know, they can't die, you know, I mean, there is actually some very specific privileges. Things like limited liability is one of the big ones, where, you know, if your corporation does something terrible, any kind of punishment goes against the corporation, but not against the officers or the shareholders or the employees or anything like that. This limited liability is a really big deal. It's one of the privileges that the state gives to somebody who wants to incorporate. And so for the last 100 years, we've kind of been at this stasis where everything is the same, all the powers are the same across states, and it was just kind of sat there. But they didn't do it for legal reasons. They didn't bump those powers all the way up for legal reasons. They did it for competitive reasons. And there's a line of cases going back 200 years, separate from Citizens United and all those cases. This is basic foundational corporation law that says, what you said earlier, states create corporations and they give them all of their powers. I mean, they don't have to give them the power to own property or sign contracts if they didn't want to. That'd be disastrous, a bad idea. But the state's authority is absolute in terms of how they define their corporations and which powers they decide to give their corporations. And there's another provision in every state's law that says, we can change this up at any time. And that's been sitting there for up to 200 years in some states. But nobody's touched it for the last 100 years. But it's just as powerful as it ever was. And this gets us to Montana. And what they've done is they've written up a constitutional ballot initiative it's got some details to it, but at the end of the day, it's pretty simple. And it says, look, we never meant to give our corporations the power to spend in politics. You said they could have that, you said they did have that power in Citizens United. And we're just going to be really clear about it now. You know, our corporations do not have the power to spend in elections. And when a state does that, Montana's going first, but every state can do this. When a state does that, their own corporations, ones that they charter, are out of politics anywhere in the galaxy. But one more thing that's in almost every state's laws says no out-of-state corporation can exercise any power in this state that a domestic corporation can't exercise. So what that means is, if you're Montana, you pass this, your corporations are out everywhere. But it also means that 49 states worth of out-of-state corporations also can't spend in your politics. Because if you take the power, if you no longer give the power to your domestic guys, then out-of-state corporations don't have that power either. So that's what they're doing in Montana. It is based on absolutely foundational corporation law.
How did it get in? I mean, Montana is not a state that I would have picked. Why Montana? How Montana? And what's standing in the way? Because we're talking about an election next year. You and I are actually speaking on Election Day 2025 in some localities around the country. There's elections happening, cities and some states are voting. Many states are voting. But why Montana?
There's some good strategic reasons to pick Montana, and then there's the actual reason that Montana was picked. My previous job was at the Federal Election Commission. I was counsel and chief of staff to Commissioner Ellen Weintraub, one of the commissioners there. And we worked with the Montana Commissioner of Political Practices, Jeff Mangan. Great guy, and he was doing a really good job, you know, enforcing Montana's laws. I left the FEC, he left that job. I came up with this proposal and was just bouncing it off people I know, just like, hey, what's your reaction to this? Do you think this works? And I sent him a draft of the paper and he called back that night and said, we are doing this in Montana. So if I'd had a choice of which state to start with, which I didn't, Montana would have been a good choice. They actually have this long history of fighting corporate political corruption. They hate it. They had a very strong law for a century that ended up getting overturned right after Citizens United was overturned. And they begged the court and said, like, look, we've got this incredibly, you know, horrible history of corporate corruption here. Can we please keep them out of our politics? And the Supreme Court said no. And so, you know, the people of Montana have not forgotten that. They are fiercely independent. They don't like other people coming in and telling them what to think, which is why there's this, you know, Jeff, who's a lifelong Montanan, is running this effort there. And there are also some good things. It's a red state, which is it is useful, I think, for the country to see that it's not just, you know, lefty liberals who don't like dark and corporate money in their politics. You know, independents, conservatives, Red Rock, you know, Westerners, you know, do not like any of that stuff in their politics either. So that's the reason Montana's first, but I'm working with a number of states now, both with on ballot initiatives and helping draft legislation when they want. But I think it's going to end up moving in a number of states very quickly.
Right. And just again, to be clear, what Montana is doing isn't undoing the Citizens United ruling. It's simply negating its effect on the ground. And the Supreme Court can do nothing about it, really, unless someone brings some brand new lawsuit. But then the Supreme Court would have to kind of go against, I think, its own precedents, saying that states have the right to determine corporate boundaries, right?
Right. And this court has been very willing to go against precedents. I mean, we've seen that.
That's true.
Roe v. Wade. I mean, there's that's not the reason. I think of it in terms of like two sets of China. There's a bunch of China in front of the Supreme Court that they shouldn't break. Like a good, honest, you know, judges being good judges, they shouldn't break this China. They are smashing through that China. But then there's another stack of China that this is the China they don't want to break. You know, this is foundational corporation law that if you started pulling the building, you know, the foundation blocks out from, could really destabilize American business. I don't think they want to do that. So it's not that they shouldn't do it. They shouldn't do it, but it's not that they shouldn't do it. That's not why I don't think they're going to do it. It's because it actually hurts other interests that they've got. This court rules all kinds of different ways. It very rarely, if ever, rules against what it considers to be its interests.
And I should say that there is actually a case that would go before the Supreme Court that would expand Citizens United, because there are forces in the United States that don't believe Citizens United went far enough, among them Vice President J.D. Vance, who's backing a plan to expand corporate influence on our politics, which is just quite remarkable. Can you give us some hints as to where such efforts to undermine Citizens United at the state level could sprout next? And also, is it a done deal that Montana will see it on its ballot, or do they have to get the signatures qualified, et cetera? What's the most realistic line to seeing this effort win and spread?
Sure. Well, just this week, last week, the Montana Attorney General had to make some technical decisions about the application. He turned it down. He's been turning a bunch of them down. They're all getting challenged. He frequently loses. This week, the Transparent Election Initiative, the group that's sponsoring the plan in Montana, filed a challenge to that. This week, the Montana Supreme Court said that they have until the November 17th to respond to that. So that'll get decided pretty quickly. And the folks at TEI are pretty confident that they've got the better end of the argument there. And if the Montana Supreme Court rules in their favor, that's roughly when they'll be clear to go get signatures. Montana, they need about 60,000 signatures to pass the constitutional ballot initiative. You want to get about 100,000 or so just to make sure that you've got enough when they're all counted and checked. And this is one of those things that if it gets on the ballot anywhere in the country, it will pass. This is wildly popular. Issue One did a poll just last month asking a bunch of these questions. It's like, who wants to see a reform like this? Who hates Citizens United? Who doesn't like dark and corporate money in their politics? And it's astonishing. I mean, basically, it cuts across every demographic group, Republicans, Independents, Democrats. Nobody likes this. And all of these sentiments were even stronger in Montana. By a couple points, but nobody likes it anywhere. So anywhere this is on the ballot, it will do well. And it's one of the few issues that really, you know, truly unites Americans these days. It's like, they'd really like to get their politics back. And one of the kind of, one of the inspiring things that as I've been working on this that I found is this actually gives people some hope. It gives them some agency. It's like, wait a minute, I didn't think we could do anything about this. I thought we were just at the mercy of super PACs for forever. And, you know, and all this dark money spending and all this corporate spending, we couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, you can. And like you as a person can, and you as a citizen of a state can. And this is, it's given a lot of people a lot of hope, which has been I didn't expect it early on in this, and it's been really nice to see.
I was sort of shocked when I went back to look up when Citizens United, the ruling came about, and it was only 2010 because it feels like it's been forever, but it's only really been 15 years of the nation's history, which is remarkable given what an impact it's had, how we've seen these skyrocketing corporate contributions that are untraceable and how it's really corrupted and perverted the system of small d democracy. Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is Center for American Progress the best place to find the white paper you wrote that this Montana experiment or effort is based on?
It's a good place to find the white paper on it, but if you want to go where the work's actually being done, it's a separate organization, the Transparent Election Initiative, they're at montanaplan.com.
Montanaplan.com, and we'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Tom Moore, Senior Fellow for Democracy Policy at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. A massive push for data centers around the nation threatens to undermine progress in combating climate change. Our voracious appetite for cloud storage, search engines, and most especially artificial intelligence and other digital tools has a serious real-world impact, one that threatens our very existence. A new report by the Center for Biological Diversity outlines this threat and how it can be addressed. Joining me to discuss it is Jean Sue, Energy Justice Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. She joins me from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Jean.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So, of course, we've dealt with, or lived with, I should say, issues around what powers search engines and cloud storage. And that in and of itself has been a concern. But just in the last few years, the incredible reliance on artificial intelligence seems to have hypercharged, I think, this impact, particularly as we're seeing Wall Street, you know, new startups, hedge fund investors, all of these ventures, including government support, being thrown behind this technology that uses massive amounts of energy. How serious is the fossil fuel impact of AI data centers?
So the fossil fuel impact of data centers is extremely grave and serious. Just to give you a comparison, web services, search engines, all of those things you just mentioned are 1/10 of the electricity that's needed to actually fuel AI, artificial intelligence. So that's a huge difference. What we did was that we calculated the projected carbon emissions of this surge in an AI boom, and that we found the carbon emissions from a primarily fracked gas powered expansion are incredibly large. And they're so large that they could undermine our national climate target for 2035 by 60%, in the sense that other sectors would have to actually cut an extra 60% for us to even meet our climate goal of trying to limit greenhouse gases to a livable planet.
So tell us what these sort of centers even look like. I think many people have a challenge just visualizing what we're talking about here because, you know, it's magical. You type in a bunch of prompts on your laptop and all you might think about is the energy your laptop uses when plugged into your power outlet. And you don't think about what's happening offsite or what's happening in these remote servers. What does that actually look like? And small town America is finding out what it looks like because increasingly they're having data centers being built in their backyard. So tell us the physical impact of these data centers.
Absolutely. So these data centers are huge white boxes that can actually be multiple football fields worth of space. So we are looking at many, many acres, huge white boxes, and inside are whirling computers and heat generating for the, just high power computing. When people step into these centers, they actually hear this whir, this incredibly large amount of noise that's happening because of the networks, the wires, the cables, and the computers computing. At the same time, there's so much heat that's coming from it that data centers also are needing incredible amounts of water to cool them. So the danger that we're seeing here from data centers are, one, the electricity usage. As I said before, 10 times the amount of what, you know, previous Google searches would need. And the problem with that is much of that energy is actually being created by fossil fuels and not by renewable energy. In particular, the Trump administration is incredibly bullish on keeping open coal, which is the most polluting power source, as well as fracked gas across this country to actually power them. So that is a huge impact for our climate, but also for all the reasons we have been fighting coal and gas for a long time now, which is the air pollution, the health consequences, the fact that Cancer Alley is Cancer Alley because of fracked gas and coal production. So those are the types of issues that we see on the electricity front. And separate to that, we have the incredible water usage. So as I said before, these huge white boxes need to be cooled very quickly. And so they require massive amounts of water. The problem is that a lot of these new data centers, which are, they call hyperscalers because they're so much larger than previous data centers because of the energy use, a lot of those are actually being built in water scarce states right now, including Arizona and New Mexico, where there is a new surge in development. And communities down there, we have seen them recently in Tucson, they have risen up and said, we don't want this in our backyards because it will actually deplete the water sources that we need to survive.
Right. Virginia, you and I are speaking on Tuesday, election in Virginia. There's an election that could impact whether data centers get built in that state. You know, everybody wants to be able to have ChatGPT at their fingertips, but nobody wants to have a data center in their backyard. And certainly if you think about the long-term impacts, most people would answer that it's not worth imperiling our entire species for the ability to, you know, figure out restaurant choices for the day or whatever it is that people use it for. And of course, I'm sort of being glib about ChatGPT usage, which is individual usage. There are much bigger usages that AI companies are resorting to, including things like generating AI films, which require enormous amounts of energy, you know, just creating sort of visual things out of nothing. So does your report even address water, or is it just narrowly focused on fossil fuel consumption?
So the report itself is narrowly focused on carbon emissions. Having said that, though,
I see carbon emissions, not fossil fuel consumption, but the emissions, because you're looking at different fossil fuels have different emissions sources.
Yes, absolutely. And the reason why data centers are such a problem for carbon emissions is because right now they are primarily powered by fossil fuels, so coal and fracked gas. We do also encourage some type of framework to think about water, because the water depletion issues are incredibly serious, especially in the South and water drought prone areas. But Sonali, one thing that you just mentioned that I wanted to unpack a little bit more is that it's true. Most people don't understand that, you know, just a quick search on Google, for example, a lot of the settings right now are actually defaulted into AI mode. So you could be, you know, searching for something and not knowing that you just required 100 more times electricity or 10 more times electricity than you previously thought. So that is true a lot for searches that can be done in other ways. But one of the issues that we're seeing with data centers right now is that it's very untransparent as to what is consuming the most energy. So on the one hand, yes, we have everyday people like you and I maybe using it for, you know, how to plan a trip, how to choose restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of very simple, everyday, quotidian ways to use it. But our understanding is that a vast majority of the AI issues are being used for war, the Department of War in particular, previously Department of Defense, drones, a lot of militarization activities. In lieu of all of that, it's really important that data centers start to be far more transparent than they are about what the usages are. And so when you are having these, you know, projects built in your backyard, we put out a framework, a policy framework, to push local governments who are considering permitting these huge hyperscale data centers to do a public interest test. And in that public interest test, actually force the question of, what is this being used for? If I am going to sacrifice my water, sacrifice my air for a fossil fuel power plant, have my rates increased, many, many harms that come from data centers, you actually have to tell me what it's for. Is it for my own searches to figure out restaurants I want to go to? Or is it for militarization activities? Much of this is completely kept in the dark, and it makes it very hard for public decision makers and the public to know exactly what is being sacrificed for the benefit of what. And that's a very important part of the policy framework that we want to put forward. So much is enshrouded in a black box. We actually need to break it open and understand what our public resources are actually being dedicated to. And is that worth it to us as a society?
Right. And I noticed that your report doesn't necessarily say we need to stop building data centers. You have a more modest ask, which is that we need to, at the very least, switch what powers data centers from fossil fuels to fully renewable energy. Because if we don't, we have to cut elsewhere if we want to survive. We can't have all the things that we have now and data centers and expect there to be no impact. So if we want fossil fuel powered AI data centers, we have to cut dramatically our fossil fuel energy usage elsewhere if we aren't going to have runaway climate change. Is that accurate?
So I would say that our public interest test forces the issue as to whether these data centers should be built in the first place. So we're not saying no to data centers. In fact, it's that public interest test that really should be a question for the public to have, you know, empowerment on a local level for local, you know, communities to decide whether they want it. One of the important parts about this is that we don't, you know, it's not about demonizing everyday people or everyday's usage of AI. AI is out there right now. It's, you know, often on default. We don't even know we're using it when we do a Google search. People download ChatGPT. That's their own. They're more cognizant of it. But there is a point where the public has to understand what that usage is actually, you know, what types of consequences there are of it. But on top of that, what militarization activities, what other kind of greater activities that require greater electricity usage and water usage, what are those? And as the public, do we want to support it? So I think these are questions that should be left to people, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are going to suffer the consequences. So let's bring that to them. But the second and third parts of our policy are about if it is the case that the public and public policy deciders decide that they do want this, that it is worth it to them, then let's figure out how to mitigate the energy impacts of the fossil fuel production that is coming with it in the status quo. And what we offer and really encourage two things to happen. One is that all of the energy that data center needs, we would want it to be produced on site. And so these are huge campuses. They actually call them data center campuses, which are multiple football fields worth of space. Every single rooftop, every single area on that facility, on that campus, should be covered with renewable energy to fuel that data center. And we would hope that the solar panels, the battery storage, if it's a good place to put it, the windmills, all of those different types, the microgrids, all of those different types of energy resources should absolutely be maximized on campus to feed this energy-hungry data center as much as possible. To the extent that it can't fulfill all of those needs, then yes, the data center can connect up to the grid. But what we also advocate for is right now, households, residences, small businesses, other industrial users, they are using a lot of energy on the grid. What if we actually free up capacity on the grid? So we don't need to build any more new power plants, for example, no new fossil plants to the grid. What we do instead is pay for rooftop solar and storage, microgrids, basically communities to get their own localized, reliable, and affordable energy, get them those sources that we know have been resilient in climate disasters, get that to them, pay for it, and take them off of the grid to free up capacity on the grid for these data centers. And in that case, we have a win actually for local communities who have wanted to not pay for these data utility center increases, to not have more fossil fuels in their lives, and to actually get empowered democratic systems that are renewable energy and battery and storage onto their own lives and livelihoods. And that's the type of system that we see is going to be sustainable in the long run.
Right. I mean, actually making a plan and thinking about the impact, who would have thought that that would be the way to approach a massive push in a brand new technology? And we're seeing, you know, Wall Street, corporate America, and the Trump administration steamroll ahead with no thought to the consequences. And it's falling to nonprofit organizations like yours to think through the impacts. You know, it's falling to grassroots groups and citizen organizations, concerned people who are living with its impact and who are thinking about what it's going to look like in their communities, what it's, how it's going to impact our planet. Finally, if there is a, you mentioned there's a sort of way for local communities to be empowered. How would you outline, if there are folks who are either worried about something being built in their community, because often that's some of the most effective types of activism, or if there's already something in progress, what are specific things that you suggest they do right now? And are those available in the report that Center for Biological Diversity has created?
So there is a policy platform in the report that we hope can be useful to people on the ground. What's happening all across the country right now is that communities are waking up and are surprised that a new data center is being proposed in their backyard. So we have hundreds of these types of proposals blossoming across the entire country at once. Virginia actually has 80 to 90% of the world's computing power go through it alone. So Virginia is really ground zero for all of this. But as Virginia has increasingly become saturated, big tech companies and data center operators are just searching for other places in the country. And so we are seeing New Mexico, Arizona, Georgia, Texas, much of the South and Southeast being sudden hotspots for data centers. I would say that communities, please keep your eyes open. Some of these data center proposals are actually all around you, and your town council may be on the cusp of permitting it. So I would say, find out what is going on in your community, figure out what local government, whether it's at a state level, county level, or town level, who is dealing with it, and get in front of them immediately. Ask them for a public interest test, ask for a testimony, basically get all the facts on the table so that these public lawmakers and policymakers can actually deal with all the facts as they figure out whether to approve this or not. If data centers have not reached your town yet or your county, please actually do something proactive. So right now there's a lot of reactive fights happening. There's also a proactive approach that can be done. And it starts with passing ordinances to have this public interest test. It requires one to work with utilities and the utility commission to figure out whether distributed energy resources coming to the grid is a possibility. So these are ways that absolutely on the ground communities have been the source of activism and defense against these types of consequences. It's been overwhelming for many communities because they've never dealt with this before. And there are resources online to help you understand how to unpack that. But I would say just be very alert. And there's ways that you can get this into the public discourse ASAP and figure out what are the water consequences, the electricity consequences, right. And really ask your public officials to force the data centers to become transparent about what the so-called public benefit is of these data centers for you.
Jean, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Jean Hsu, the Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, speaking to me from Washington, D.C. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Soraya, presenting Maritza, performing for one night only on November 6th. The acclaimed Portuguese fado singer blends jazz, flamenco, and more into the soulful and poetic nature of traditional Portuguese fado music. Maritza's enchanting charisma and unparalleled voice will take you on a musical journey through the culture and nightlife of Portugal. Further information and tickets are available at thesoraya.org and kpfk.org.
Trago fado no meu canto, canto a noite até ser dia.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth.